Welcome to Adventures in Theater History. We're jumping in with a quick episode this time about a Broadway show that had its tryout in Philadelphia during the 1940s. This is an approach to an episode that I'm trying out myself. I believe I mentioned last fall in our introduction to the whole season 3 that I would occasionally be putting out brief single subject episodes instead of our usual 40-minute or so broad-ranging ones. Now, I fully intended to start throwing in some of these quickie episodes right away back then, but for one reason or another, I never really followed up on that idea. But now, I have the perfect subject for it because we've just reached the point in the timeline for a classic Broadway musical that, again, as I mentioned in the intro, had its tryout, in fact, its world premiere in Philadelphia. Cole Porter's Kiss Me, Kate. So first we have to go back to September of 1935. In the worst years of the Great Depression, Philadelphia theatergoers still had their choice of some great classic stage comedies coming through town to lift their spirits. For instance, the famous husband and wife team of Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne were at the Chestnut Street Opera House with the Theatre Guild production of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. The Lunt's conception of the play kept Shakespeare's often discarded framing device of Christopher Sly, although the actor playing him moved quickly into one of the theater stage boxes, drunkenly yelling witticisms at the stage or the audience throughout the show. Now, the framing device having been dealt with, their version of Shakespeare's Italian comedy about the brash Petruchio wooing, or if you will, taming of Catherine, the fiery and scornful elder daughter of a Padua merchant, was full of full-on swashbuckling slapstick, set, by the way, to jazz music. It was, by all accounts, quite a show, but it did prompt one sedate Philadelphia lady in the opening night audience to murmur, but it isn't Shakespeare. Nonetheless, that production went on to New York and Broadway, where it had a great run that season. It was one of the shows that really helped cement Lunt and Fontanne's reputation as the greatest pair of classical actors in the business. Now, working backstage as an assistant stage manager was a young man named Arnold St. Suber. He was the son of Saul St. Suber, one of the biggest ticket brokers in New York. Arnold St. Suber, who everyone just called Saint, couldn't help notice that the Lunts quarreled almost as much offstage as they did in the play. He sort of filed that away. He always thought that there was a play in that somewhere. 10 years later, he took the idea to composer Cole Porter. Cole Porter had just merrily rolled along throughout the Great Depression. The former Yale undergrad shows had regularly come through Philadelphia on their way to Broadway for the last 2 decades, starting with the revue Hitchy Coo of 1922, and then the Irene Bordoni vehicle Paris in 1928, and the musical called The New Yorkers in 1930. In fact, it was while Porter was stuck working on that show in Philadelphia that he longingly wrote the eventual hit number for the show, Take Me Back to Manhattan. And despite the generally depressed world of theater in the 1930s, Porter's own successes just kept on coming, including Gay Divorce in 1930 and Anything Goes in 1934, starring Ethel Merman. Porter lived a pretty high life, too, when the rest of the country was right on its uppers, with an inherited fortune to support his extravagant lifestyle and an indulgent older wife, who also had a fortune, whom he adored, but who never interfered in all his many liaisons with male lovers. But in the fall of 1937, Cole Porter suffered a terrible accident while riding at a friend's estate on Long Island. The horse he was riding on rolled over, fell on both of his legs, crushing them, and then rolled back again and broke the bones in multiple places. It was really horrific. He probably should have had both his legs amputated, but he would not consent to that. He couldn't bear the thought of having no legs. Instead, he spent the rest of his life in constant pain, undergoing dozens and dozens of operations and medical procedures every year. But he kept on working. And now he started collaborating with yet another husband and wife team, Sam and Bella Cohen Spiewak. Both of them, born in Eastern Europe, had once been news correspondents in Russia during the 1920s, but now the couple had settled in New Hope, Pennsylvania, just north of Philadelphia. Sam would turn out novels of his own, but mostly the pair wrote screenplays and stage comedies together, including Boy Meets Girl, which was a big hit, also in the year 1935. In 1938, the Spiewaks teamed up with Cole Porter on a show called Leave It to Me, starring William Gaxton, Victor Moore, Sophie Tucker, and a 22-year-old Mary Martin, who made a debut smash with the number My Heart Belongs to Daddy. Drawing on the Spiewaks' Russian experiences, the show even featured a finale with an actor playing Joseph Stalin singing the Internationale. And despite his pain, he kept writing musicals, including Du Barry Was a Lady with Ethel Merman and Burt Lahr in 1939. In his years of illness, Porter became increasingly known not only for his lovely melodies and charming scores, but also for his intricate lyrics, which didn't just employ double entendres. They were clearly about sex, such as the duet he wrote called But in the Morning, No, which could not get any airtime on the radio of the days. Burt Lahr, in fact, once said that when Cole Porter got dirty, it was dirt, without subtlety. Nothing I sang in burlesque was as risque as his lyrics. But when he reached the 1940s, this was a frustrating time for Porter as a Broadway composer. He was intimidated by the innovations of Rodgers and Hammerstein's in shows such as Oklahoma and Carousel. The well-integrated book and score was maybe beyond his talents, he feared. Increasingly, he was turning out a lot of flop shows and experiencing a lot of bad reviews, and he was in so much pain from his legs, and his wife was increasingly ill. But he kept going. By 1947, he was working on a Gene Kelly film out in Hollywood called The Pirate, which was, in fact, based on another former Lunt-Fontanne play. And then someone, it may have been St. Suber, or it may have been Bella Spiewak, came to him with an idea based on a Lunt-Fontanne hit, The Taming of the Shrew, from 1935. Or rather, it was a backstage musical about The Taming of the Shrew. The idea was to utilize a couple of famous Shakespearean actors, obviously based on the Lunts, but with their names changed to Frederick Graham and Lily Vanessi. Fred and Lily, in this idea, would be working together on a new musical version of Shakespeare, even though they were now technically divorced. Their sparring and bickering backstage matched those of their real-life examples, both the Lunts and the Spiewaks, frankly, who were by then having their own marital troubles. Sam, at Bella's insistence, always got full billing as a co-creator of the show. But even he admitted that the script really was Bella's. She even threw in a great subplot where a couple of Baltimore gangsters come in to collect a gambling debt that they claim Fred owes them, and he adroitly ends up roping them in to become part of the cast of the show. Cole Porter took right to the ideas, enthusiastically writing to Bella Spiewak that her script was, quote, the best musical comedy book that I have ever read. He very quickly wrote a majority of the show's songs in an amazingly compact burst of creativity. And they really were wonderfully theatrical. We open in Venice, neatly capture the life of the touring players of the distant Italian Renaissance, and another opening, another show, for its part, detailed the traditional tryout route of the hopeful American musicals of the mid-20th century. In one weekend, he came up with both Where is the Life That Late I Led? And, using Shakespeare's own words, I've Come to Wive It Wealthily in Padua. Some of his most adroit and sexy numbers were the opening to the second act, Too Darn Hot, and the numbers for the secondary female lead, Lois Lane, to sing to her boyfriend, Why Can't You Behave and Always True to You in My Fashion. The meltingly beautiful melody of So In Love was brought out for the first act, sung by Lily and then repeated by Fred in the second act in agony when he thinks he's really going to lose her to a wealthy rival and admits to himself and to us that he really wants her back. In fact, Porter wrote 6 songs that eventually had to be dropped from the show, but it wasn't because they weren't fantastic. They just didn't fit in with the script. But by the end of the summer, the show was mostly ready to go. Clearly, Cole was back at the top of his game once again.
The girls today in society go for classical poetry.
And in a number that Bella didn't originally want, but that Porter couldn't resist writing, he created a number for the two gangsters that he thought any couple of decent vaudevillians could manage. Brush Up Your Shakespeare, using a sort of bawdry right in tune with Shakespeare's own rudest jokes. And in the end, Bella had to admit that he was right. She later remembered, "I knew Cole had finally come through brilliantly. I knew what I had done and what Sam had done was right. We had nothing to change. I knew it, so I didn't have to be superstitious. In the history of American musicals, this is the only one where they didn't have to touch a scene or a song." St. Suber and the designer Lemuel Ayers teamed up as producers, and they were quickly able to gather an A-list group of backers, including his dad, Saul Suber, the New Yorker publisher Raoul Fleischman, the actor Rollo Peters, the actress, our old friend Peggy Wood, who wrote the book on John Drew Jr., Mrs. Whitney Choate, and Ellen Tuck, Mrs. John Jacob Astor, to you and me. Casting for the show was reported breathlessly in all the showbiz gossip columns of the day. Alfred Drake, the dramatic baritone who had been the original Curly in Oklahoma, was signed up for Fred. Patricia Morrison was just right for the part of Lily, Porter decided after a brief audition. She even looked like Lynn Fontanne. The young Lisa Kirk and Harold Lang were signed up for the younger pair of battling lovers. And after all that remained was the matter of the out-of-town tryouts for the show, of course. Should it be sent on the usual round of cities? New Haven, Baltimore, Boston? Indeed, those latter two cities were right there in the lyrics of the opening number. And the action of where the play within the play, The Shrew, supposedly took place, was in Ford's Theater in Baltimore. So maybe they should have started in Baltimore. "How's the house?" Frederick Graham asked the stage manager nervously. "You know Baltimore," replies the stage manager. "I know," snaps Fred. "There will be deer running around the balcony. Next time I play Baltimore, I'll bring my shotgun and eat." But Ayers and St. Suber decided that there was really only one tryout town needed: Philadelphia, during the weeks of December leading up to Christmas. And soon, Philadelphia's own wealthy set of reliable first-nighters were lining up for tickets at the brokers. The Brownings, the Caldwells, Edgar and Hope Montgomery Scott, the George Strawbridges, the Biddles. The Schubert Organization, our old friends, coming in gracefully with a little extra backing right at the end, that end money they were always good for, offered the producers the Schubert Theater on Broad Street. And remembering the public scandal over Annie Get Your Gun 2 years previously, they promised that this time there would be no ticket shenanigans. "Oh, sure there won't," winked St. Suber, who, after all, knew precisely what they were up to, and that Lee Schubert was going to hold on to his usual 60 house seats per performance to distribute in his own way. Meanwhile, the production had quickly built up $150,000 in legit box office sales, already almost covering its costs, and the Schuberts moved its scheduled Broadway home from the Broadhurst, close to Times Square, to the New Century Theater, which was way up north near Central Park, but it had 500 more seats. Rehearsals for Kiss Me, Kate began in October, under the lead of director John C. Wilson, up on the old roof garden of the New Amsterdam Theater on 42nd Street. Cole Porter attended each rehearsal personally, despite his aching legs, always dressed elegantly and leaning on 2 gold-topped canes. and he had a whistle on a string around his neck, and from time to time he would blow it whenever he felt the lyrics were not coming across. The lyrics counted more, remembered one of the dancing chorus, than the dancing or anything else. Just before the troupe headed down to Philadelphia, there was a final run-through for the company with no sets or costumes, only a rehearsal piano plunking out the accompaniment. The show seemed oddly flat, and everyone got nervous for a moment. There were some big Broadway names like the director Moss Hart and the choreographer Agnes DeMille there to witness it too. Afterwards, both of them looked decidedly grim. It was only when the company got down to Philadelphia, got into their costumes, got on the set, and finally got to hear the lush and stunning orchestral arrangements that had been made for the show by the great arranger Robert Russell Bennett. And everyone knew, once again, this show was wonderful. This thing was truly brilliant. Opening night in Philadelphia to a glittering audience at the Schubert Theater was on Thursday, December 2nd, 1948. Cole Porter came down himself to Philadelphia with a retinue of friends, and to calm his nerves, he even brought along 5 paintings to make his suite in the Bellevue Stratford Hotel more agreeable, including a large snowscape by Grandma Moses that he was particularly fond of. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette noted that he gave an interview in which he predicted that this show would sweep Lisa Kirk, a Pennsylvanian from the western part of the state, right to the top. So, obviously the Moses painting was doing good work. But, so, how did it all go? Well, we have lots of evidence. In those days, a lot of national publications would show up to important out-of-town premieres, and so a lot of reviewers were very well familiar with the Quaker City scene. To name one, the critic for Variety wrote in that trade paper's idiosyncratic lingo, "Not since Finian's Rainbow, and before that, Bloomer Girl, has Philly had a musical preem that showed the class and style of Kiss Me Kate, or received its sucko reception. Here is a show that can't miss, with a powerhouse appeal and almost miraculous harnessing of book and score. The humor of the book is, unusually enough, both keenly satiric and subtly literate, but also possessed of hilarious, even rowdy, qualities." Meanwhile, the Philadelphia area papers were all delighted too. "There is only one thing that Cole Porter and the producers will have to worry about," wrote the Camden Evening Courier, "and that is the excess profit taxes, because Kiss Me Kate should be on Broadway for a long time, and it is certain it will not be in Philadelphia long enough to take care of all the many who will want to see it." The theater critic of the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin in those days was the magnificently named R.E.P. Sensenderfer, who began his enthusiastic review with the words, "Hat tossing high in the air is the order of the day for Kiss Me Kate, the new musical that completely won an overflow audience at the Schubert last night, where it was given with a will. For the first time anywhere, the music and lyrics are Cole Porter at his tuneful best, and the production and performance tops. What more could anybody ask?" The Philadelphia Inquirer, for its part, thought that the occasion demanded more than hat-tossing. "A salute of 21 guns is in order this morning," gushed Edwin H. Schloss, "and maybe you'd better make it 25 to celebrate the arrival of one of the most brilliantly entertaining, charming, and beguiling musicals in many a season. The show fairly rocketed to distinction, and it's going to take a thesaurus full of superlatives to give you even a working blueprint of a delightful evening." And writing in the Sunday Inquirer, Schloss's colleague, our old friend Linton Martin, chimed in that Bella Spiewak's treatment was enough to make him discard his former dislike of the show within a show backstage musical conceit. Martin lauded every member of the cast, and especially Cole Porter, for his, quote, "saucily sophisticated lyrics and tunes in the hit-studded musical score." Faced with all this overwhelming Philadelphia praise and the entirely sold-out run of the sophisticated show in the supposedly staid and stodgy Quaker City, the delighted composer was immediately writing to one of his friends that, quote, "My new show opened in Philadelphia, and it is the biggest hit of my life." To another, Porter simply telegraphed, "Smash equals coal." Well, that was one of the absolute happiest stories I think I've ever had the pleasure of sharing with you folks. I must say, it has given me a great deal of personal pleasure to spend some more time with the musical Kiss Me, Kate, a show which I myself performed a couple of times back in my own younger days, and one that I remember with absolute and complete fondness. Oh, and how did that other opening night of Kiss Me, Kate go, you ask? The one on December 30th. 1948, at the New Century Theater up in New York, when it took Porter back to Manhattan once again. Well, that's outside of the purview of our podcast. Suffice it to say that the New York critics and audiences were no less wowed than their counterparts in Philadelphia. Let me leave you with a story from the great 1998 biography of Cole Porter by the author William McBrien. From the theater, where the audience reluctantly departed, filled with enthusiasm for a great new hit, Porter proceeded to the duplex of Sophie and Van Schley at 666 Park Avenue. Lisa Kirk once said that her most poignant memory was arriving at the Schleys and being greeted by St. Subber at the top of the long stairway. He was waving a newspaper and announcing that the show was a hit. Cole threw his canes down and walked up the whole flight of stairs, unassisted. "I just stood there, crying," said Kirk. At the party, Patricia Morrison, when asked to speak, said, "I feel like Cole Porter is 6 feet tall, wears golden armor, carries a sword instead of a cane, and has just lifted me out of my pumpkin coach." And not long after, Cole Porter was sending around copies of the cast album of Kiss Me, Kate to all his dearest friends with a card that read simply, "Love, from Cole."
Why, there's a wench. Come on and kiss me, Kate.
Well, that's our show for today. Thanks for letting me try out this shorter format. We'll be back next time with that roundup I promised you of serious shows that came through Philadelphia in the post-war period. Look for it, coming up on your podcast feeds. This is Peter Schmitz, and our original theme music is by Christopher Mark Colucci. The sound editing and engineering for this episode was all done by my humble self here at our studios in our world headquarters, high atop the tower of theater history. Thank you for listening and for coming along on another adventure in theater history, Philadelphia.